This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Dragonbone Chair, Book 1 of Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn, by Tad Williams. Read for you by Andrew Wincott.
Author's Warning. Wanderers in the land of Ost and Ard are cautioned not to put blind trust in old rules and forms, and to observe all rituals with a careful eye, for they often mask being with seeming. The Canuck folk of the snow-mantled Trollfells have a proverb: "He who is certain he knows the ending of things when he is only beginning them is either extremely wise or extremely foolish. No matter which is true, he is certainly an unhappy man, for he has put a knife in the heart of wonder." More bluntly, new visitors to this land should take heed. Avoid assumptions. The Canuck have another saying: "Welcome, stranger. The paths are treacherous today." Forward. The book of the mad priest Nisez is large, say those who have held it, and as heavy as a small child. It was discovered at Nisse's side as he lay, dead and smiling, beside the tower window from which his master, King Hjeldin, had leaped to his own death moments before. The rusty brown ink, concocted of lamb's foil, hellebore and rue, as well as some redder, thicker liquid, is dry and flakes easily from the thin pages. The unadorned skin of a hairless animal, the species unprovable, forms the binding. Those holy men of Naban who read it after Nissi's passing pronounced it heretical and dangerous, but for some reason did not burn it, as is usually done with such texts. Instead, it lay for many years in Mother Church's near endless archives, in the deepest, most secret vaults of the Sankelen Adonitis. It has now apparently disappeared from the onyx casket which housed it. The never-gregarious order of the archives is vague as to its present whereabouts. Some who have read Nissi's heretical work claim that it contains all the secrets of Ost and Ard, from this land's murky past to the shadows of things unborn. The Adonite priest examiners will say only that its subject matter was unholy. It may indeed be true that Nisse's writings predict the what will be as clearly, and we may presume eccentrically, as they chronicle the what has been. It is not known, however, whether the great deeds of our age, especially for our concern the rise and triumph of Prester John, are included in the priest's foretellings, although there are suggestions that this may be true. Much of Nisse's writing is mysterious, its meaning hidden in strange rhymes and obscure references. I have never read the full work, and most of those who have are now long dead. The book is titled, in the cold, harsh runes of Nisse's northern birthplace, Dusfadenvird, which means the Weird of the Swords. From The Life and Reign of King John Presbyter by Morgane's Acestres. Part 1. Simon Mooncalf. Chapter 1. The Grasshopper and the King. On this day of days, there was an unfamiliar stirring deep inside the dozing heart of the Hayholt, in the castle's bewildering warren of quiet passages and overgrown, ivy-choked courtyards, in the monks' holes and damp, shadowed chambers. Courtiers and servants alike goggled and whispered. Scullions exchanged significant glances across the washing tubs in the steamy kitchen. Hushed conversations seemed to be taking place in every hallway and dooryard of the great keep. It might have been the first day of spring, to judge from the air of breathless anticipation, but the great calendar in Dr. Morgane's cluttered chamber showed differently. The month was only November. Autumn was holding the door, and winter was trudging in. What made this day a day different from all others was not a season, but a place. The Heyholt's throne room. For 3 long years its doors had been shut by the king's order, and heavy draperies had cloaked the multicoloured windows. Even the cleaning servants had not been permitted to cross the threshold, causing the mistress of chambermaids no end of personal anguish. 3 summers and 3 winters it had stood undisturbed. Today it was no longer empty, and all the castle hummed with rumour. In truth, there was one person in the busy Heyholt whose attention was not fixed on that long, untenanted room. One bee in the murmuring hive whose solitary song was not in key with the greater droning. That one sat in the heart of the hedge garden, in an alcove between the dull red stone of the chapel and the leafless side of a skeletal hedge lion, and thought he was not missed. It had been an irritating day so far, the women all busy with scant time to answer questions, breakfast late and cold into the bargain. Confusing orders had been given to him, as usual, and no one had any time to waste with any of his problems. And that was also, he thought grumpily, quite predictable. If it hadn't been for his discovery of this huge, magnificent beetle, which had come strolling across the garden, as self-satisfied as any prosperous villager, then the entire afternoon would have been a waste of time. With a twig he widened the tiny road he had scraped in the dark, cold earth beside the wall, but still the captive would not walk forward. He tickled gently at its glossy carapace, but the stubborn beetle would not budge. Frowning, he sucked at his upper lip.
"Simon, where in the name of holy creation have you been?"
The twig dropped from his nerveless fingers, as though an arrow had pierced his heart. Slowly, he turned to look at the looming shape.
"Nowhere,"
Simon began to say, but even as the words passed his lips, a pair of bony fingers caught his ear and brought him sharply to his feet, yelping in pain.
"Don't you dare nowhere me, young layabout!"
Rachel the dragon, mistress of chambermaids, barked full into his face, a juxtaposition made possible only by Rachel's tiptoed stance and the boy's natural inclination to slouch, for the head chambermaid lacked nearly a foot of Simon's height.
"Sorry, then, mistress, I'm sorry,"
Simon muttered, noting with sadness the beetle nosing toward a crack in the chapel wall and freedom.
"Sorry is not going to get you by forever," Rachel growled. "Every single body in the house is at work at getting things ready but you, and bad enough that is. But then I have to waste my valuable time trying to find you. How can you be such a wicked boy, Simon, when you should be acting like a man? How can you?"
The boy, 14 gangly years old, and furiously embarrassed, said nothing. Rachel stared at him.
"Sad enough," she thought, "that red hair and those spots. But when he squints his eyes all up that way and scowls, why, the child looks half-witted."
Simon, staring in turn at his captor, saw Rachel breathing heavily, pluming the Novanda air with puffs of vapour. She was shivering, too, although whether from the cold or anger, Simon couldn't tell. It didn't really matter. It just made him feel worse.
"She's still waiting for an answer. How tired and cross she looks."
He curled himself into an even more pronounced slump and glared at his own feet.
"Well, you'll just come with me then. The good Lord knows I've got things to keep an idle boy busy with. Don't you know the king is up out of his sick bed? That he's gone to his throne room today? Are you deaf and blind?"
She grabbed his elbow and frog-marched him across the garden.
"The king? King John?"
Simon asked, surprised.
"No, you ignorant boy, King Stone in the road. Of course, King John."
Rachel halted in her tracks to push a wisp of limp steel-grey hair back under her bonnet. Her hand trembled.
"There, I hope you're happy," she said. "You've gotten me so flummoxed and upset that I've gone and been disrespectful to the name of our good old King John. And him so sick and all?"
she snuffled loudly, and then leaned over to deal Simon a stinging slap on the fat part of his arm.
Just you come!
She stumped forward, wicked boy in tow. Simon had never known any other home but the ageless castle called Hayholt, which meant High Keep. It was well named. Green Angel Tower, its loftiest point, soared far above even the eldest and tallest of trees. If the angel herself, perched on the tower top, had dropped a stone from her verdigrised hand, it would have plummeted nearly 200 cubits before splashing into the brackish moat and troubling the sleep of the great pikefish bobbing close above the centuried mud. The Hayholt was older by far than all the generations of Erkinlandish peasants who had been born, laboured and died in the fields and villages surrounding the great keep. The Erkinlanders were only the latest to claim the castle. Many others had called it their own, but none had been able to make it wholly so. The outwall around the sprawling keep showed the work of diverse hands and times. The rough-hewn rock and timber of the Rimmer's men, the haphazard patching and strange carvings of the Hernisteri, even the meticulous stonework of Nabene craftsmen. But looming over all stood Green Angel Tower, erected by the undying Scythi long before men had come to these lands, when all of Austin Ard had been their dominion. The Scythi had been the first to build here, constructing their primeval stronghold on the headlands overlooking the Kinsla and the river road to the sea. They had called their castle Aswa. If it had a true name, this house of many masters, then Aswa was that name. The fair folk had vanished now from the grassy plains and rolling hill country, fled mostly to the woods and craggy mountains and other dark places inconvenient to men. The bones of their castle, a home to usurpers, remained behind. Aswa the paradox, proud, yet ramshackle, festive and forbidding, seemingly oblivious to changes of tenantry. Aswa the Hayholt. It bulked mountainously above the outlands and town, hunched over its fief like a sleeping, honey-muzzled bear among her cubs. It often seemed that Simon was the only dweller in the great castle who had not settled into his place in life. The masons plastered the whitewashed facing of the residence and shored up the castle's crumbling walls. Although the crumbling did sometimes seem to outpace the restorations, with never a thought toward how the world spun or why. The pantlers and butlers, whistling merrily, rolled huge casks of sack and salted beef here and there. With the castle seneschal beside them, they haggled with farmers over the whiskery onions and soil-moist carrots brought in sacks to the Hayholt's kitchen every morning. And Rachel and her chambermaids were always excruciatingly busy, flourishing their brooms of bound straw, chasing dust balls as if herding skittish sheep, muttering pious imprecations about the way some people left a chamber when they departed, and generally terrorizing the slothful and slovenly. In the midst of such industry, Gorky Simon was the fabled grasshopper in the nest of ants. He knew he would never amount to much. Many people had told him so, and nearly all of them were older and presumably wiser than he. At an age when other boys were clamoring for the responsibilities of manhood, Simon was still a muddler and a meanderer. No matter what task he was given to do, his attention soon wandered, and he would be dreaming of battles and giants and sea voyages on tall, shining ships, and somehow things would get broken or lost or done wrong. Other times he could not be found at all. He skulked around the castle like a scrawny shadow, could shinny up a wall as well as the roof masons and glaziers, and knew so many passageways and hiding holes that the castle folk called him Ghost Boy. Rachel boxed his ears frequently and called him a moon calf. Rachel had finally let go of his arm, and Simon dragged his feet glumly as he followed the mistress of chambermaids like a stick caught in a skirt hem. He had been discovered, his beetle had escaped, and the afternoon was ruined. "What must I do, Rachel?" he mumbled unpleasantly. "Help in the kitchen?" Rachel snorted disdainfully and waddled on, a badger in an apron. Simon looked back regretfully on the sheltering trees and hedges of the garden. Their commingled footfalls resounded solemnly down the long stone hallway. He had been raised by the chambermaids, but since he was certainly never going to be one himself, his boyness aside, Simon was obviously not to be trusted with delicate domestic operations. A concerted effort had been made to find suitable labors for him. In a great house, and the hayholt was doubtless the greatest, there was no place for those who did not work. He found employment of a sort in the castle kitchens, but even at this undemanding job he was not completely successful. The other scullions would laugh and nudge each other to see Simon, elbow deep in hot water, eyes squinted shut in oblivious reverie, learning the trick of bird flight, or saving dream maidens from imaginary beasts as his scrubbing stick floated off across the washing vat. Legend had it that Sir Fleuren, a relative of the famous Sir Camaris of Naban, had in his youth come to the hayholt to be a knight, and had worked a year in disguise in this same scullery due to his ineffable humility. The kitchen workers had teased him, or so the story went, calling him Pretty Hands, because the terrible toil did not diminish the fine whiteness of his fingers. Simon had only to look at his own cracked nail, pink-boiled paws, to know that he was no great lord's orphan son. He was a scullion and a corner sweeper, and that was that. At a not much greater age, everyone knew King John had slain the Red Dragon. Simon wrestled with brooms and pots. Not that it made much difference. It was a different, quieter world than in John's youth, thanks largely to the old king himself. No dragons, living ones anyway, inhabited the dark, endless halls of the hayholt. But Rachel, as Simon often cursed to himself, with her sour face and terrible, tweezing fingers, was near enough. They reached the antechamber before the throne room, the center of the inordinate activity. The chambermaids, moving at a near run, careened from wall to wall like flies in a bottle. Rachel stood with fists set on hips and surveyed her domain, seeming from the smile that tightened her thin mouth to find it good. Simon lurked against a tapestried wall, forgotten for a moment. Slouching, he stared from the corner of his eyes at the new girl, Hepzibah, who was plump and curly-haired and walked with an insolent sway. Passing by with a sloshing bucket of water, she caught his glance and smiled widely, amused. Simon felt fire crackling up his neck into his cheeks and turned to pick at the tattered wall hanging. Rachel had not missed the exchange of looks.
"Lord whip you for a donkey, boy! Didn't I tell you to get to work? Have at it, then!"
"At what? Do what?" Simon shouted, and was mortified to hear Hepzibah's silvery giggle float out from the hallway. He pinched his own arm in frustration. It hurt.
"Take this broom and go and sweep out the doctor's chambers. That man lives like a pack rat, and who knows where the king will want to go now that he's up."
It was clear from her tone that Rachel found the general contrariness of men to be undiminished by kingship.
"Dr. Morgani's chambers?" Simon asked. For the first time since he had been discovered in the garden, his spirits rose.
"I'll do it straight away."
He snatched the broom at a dead run and was gone. Rachel snorted and turned back to examine the spotless perfection of the antechamber. She briefly wondered what could possibly be going on behind the great throne room door, then dismissed the errant thought as mercilessly as she might swat a hovering gnat. Herding her legions with clapping hands and steely eye, she led them out of the antechamber and off to another pitched battle against her arch-enemy, Disorder. In that hall beyond the door, dusty banners hung, row upon row along the walls, a faded bestiary of fantastic animals, the sun-golden stallion of Clan Meriden, Navan's gleaming kingfisher crest, owl and ox, otter, unicorn, and cockatrice, rank after rank of silent, sleeping creatures. No draught stirred these threadbare hangings. Even the spiderwebs sagged empty and unstitched. Some small change had come to the throne room, though. Something lived once more in the shadowed chamber. Someone was singing a quiet tune in the thin voice of a very young boy or a very old man. At the farthest end of the hall, a massive tapestry hung on the stone wall between the statues of the High Kings of the Hayholt, a tapestry bearing the royal coat of arms, the fire drake and the tree. The grim Malachite statues, an honor guard of six, flanked a huge heavy chair that seemed entirely carved from yellowing ivory. The chair arms knobbed and knuckled, the back capped with a huge many-toothed serpentine skull, whose eyes were pools of shadow. It was on and before this chair that two figures sat. The small one clothed in worn motley was singing. It was his voice that floated up from the foot of the throne, too weak to chip loose even a slight echo. Over him bent a gaunt shape, perched at the end of the chair like an aged raptor, a tired, hobbled bird of prey shackled to the dull bone. The king, 3 years sick and enfeebled, had returned to his dusty hall. He listened as the small man at his feet sang. The king's long, mottled hands grasped the arms of his great, yellowing throne. He was a tall man, once very tall, but now hunched like a monk at prayer. He wore a sagging robe of sky blue, and was bearded like a Osirian prophet. A sword lay athwart his lap, shining as though new polished. On his brow sat an iron crown, studded all about with sea-green emeralds and secretive opals. The mannequin at the king's feet paused for a long, silent moment, then began another song. Can the count the raindrops when the sun is high? Can the swim the river when the bed gang dry? Can the catch a cloud? Nay, canst not, nor I. Can the wind a cry, wait, as a passeth by? The wind a cry, wait, as a passeth by. When the tune was finished, the tall old man in the blue robe reached down his hand and the jester took it. Neither said a word. John the Presbyter, Lord of Erkinland, and High King of all Austin Ard, scourge of the Scythi and defender of the true faith, wielder of the sword Brightnail, bane of the dragon Shurikay. Prester John was sitting once more upon his chair made of dragon's bones. He was very, very old, and had been crying. Ah, Towser, he breathed at last, his voice deep but flawed with age. It is surely an unmerciful God who could bring me to this sorry pass.
Perhaps, my lord.
The little old man in the checkered jerkin smiled a wrinkled smile.
Perhaps. But doubtless many others would not complain of cruelty if brought to your station in life.
But that is just what I mean, old friend.
The king shook his head angrily.
In this shadow age of infirmity, all men are leveled. Any thick-witted tailor's apprentice sups more of life than I.
Ah, la now, my lord, my lord.
Towser's grizzled head wagged from side to side, but the bells of his cap, long since clapperless, did not jingle.
My lord, you complain seasonably, but unreasonably. All men come to this pass, great or small. You have had a fine life.
Prester John lifted the hilt of Brightnail before him, holding it as though it were a holy tree. He pulled the back of a long, thin hand across his eyes.
Do you know the story of this blade? He asked.
Towser looked up sharply. He had heard the story many times.
Tell me, O king, he said quietly.
Prester John smiled, but his eyes never left the leather-bound hilt before him.
A sword, small friend, is the extension of a man's right hand, and the end point of his heart.
He lifted the blade up higher, so that it caught a glimmer of light from one of the tiny high windows.
Just the same is man, the good right hand of God. Man is the sharp executor of the heart of God, do you see?
Suddenly he was leaning down, eyes bird bright beneath shaggy brows.
Do you know what this is?
His shaking finger indicated a bit of crumped rusty metal bound into the sword haft with golden wire.
Tell me, Lord,
Towser knew perfectly well.
This is the only nail of the true execution tree still remaining in Austin Ard.
Prester John brought the hilt forward to his lips and kissed it, then held the cool metal against his cheek.
This nail came from the palm of Osiris Aiden, our savior, from his hand.
The king's eyes, catching for a moment a strange half-light from above, were fiery mirrors.
And there is also the relic, of course,
he said after a quiet moment,
the finger bone of martyred Saint Aelstan, the dragon slain, right here in the hilt.
There was another interval of silence, and when Towser looked up, his master was weeping again.
Fie on it, John moaned. How can I live up to the honor of God's sword, with so much sin, such a weight of it, still staining my soul? The arm that once smote the red dragon can now scarce lift a milk cup. Oh, I am dying, my dear Towser. Dying.
Towser leaned forward, pulling one of the king's bony hands free from the sword grip and kissing it as the old man sobbed.
Oh, please, master,
the jester beseeched.
Weep no more. All men must die. You, I, everyone. If we are not killed by youthful stupidity or ill luck, then it is our fate to live on like the trees, older and older until at last we totter and fall. It is the way of all things. How can you fight the Lord's will?
But I built this kingdom.
A quivering rage was on John the Presbyter as he pulled his hand free from the jester's grasp and brought it sharply down on the arm of his throne.
That must weigh against any blot of sin on my soul, however dark. Surely the good Lord will have that in his book of accounts. I dragged these people up from the mud, scourged the cursed sneaking Scythi out of the countryside, gave the peasantry law and justice. The good I have done must weigh strongly.
For a moment John's voice became fainter, as though his thoughts wandered elsewhere.
Ah, my old friend,
he said at last in a bitter voice,
and now I cannot even walk down to the marketplace on Main Row. I must lie in bed or shuffle about this cold castle on the arms of younger men. My kingdom lies corrupting on the vine, while servants whisper and tiptoe outside my bedchamber door. All in sin.
The king's words echoed back from the chamber's stone walls and slowly dissipated up among the swirling dust motes. Towser regained John's hand and squeezed it until the king was composed once more.
Well, said Prester John after some time had passed, my Elias will rule more firmly than I now can, at least, seeing the decay of all this.
He swept his hand around the throne room.
Today I have decided to call him back from Merrimond. He must prepare to take the crown.
The king sighed.
I suppose I should leave off my womanish weeping, and be grateful I have what many kings have not, a strong son to hold my kingdom together after I am gone.
Two strong sons, lord.
Fah, the king grimaced. I should call Joshua many things, but I do not believe strong is one of them.
You are too hard on him, master.
Nonsense! Do you think to instruct me, jester? Do you know the son better than the father does?
John's hand trembled, and for a moment it seemed he would struggle to his feet. Finally, the tension slackened.
Joshua is a cynic.
The king began again in a quieter voice.
A cynic, a melancholic, cold to his inferiors. And a king's son has nothing but inferiors, each one a potential assassin. No, Taos, he is a queer one, my younger. Most especially since he lost his hand. Ah, merciful Aedon, perhaps the fault is mine.
What do you mean, lord?
I should have taken another wife after Hebecca died. It has been a cold house without a queen. Perhaps that caused the boy's odd humors. Elias is not that way, though.
There is a certain crude directness to Prince Elias' nature,
Towser muttered. But if the king heard, he gave no sign.
I thank beneficent God that Elias was first born. He has a brave, martial character, that one. I think that if he were the younger, Joshua would not be secure upon the throne.
King John shook his head with cold fondness at the thought, then groped down and grasped his jester's ear, tweaking it, as if that old worthy were a child of 5 or 6 years.
Promise me one thing, Taos.
What, lord?
When I die, doubtless soon, I do not think I shall last the winter. You must bring Elias to this room. Do you suppose they will hold the crowning here? Never mind you, if they do, then you must wait until it has ended. Bring him here, and give him Brightnail. Yes, take it now, and hold it. I fear that I may die while he is away at Merrimond, or some other place, and I wanted to come straight to his hand with my blessing. Do you understand, Taos?
With shaking hands, Prester John pushed the sword back into its tooled scabbard and struggled for a moment to unbuckle the baldric on which it hung. The twining was caught, and Towser got up on his knees to work on the knot with his strong, old fingers.
"What is the blessing, my lord?"
he asked, tongue between teeth as he picked at the tangle.
"Tell him what I have told you. Tell him that the sword is the point of his heart and hand, just as we are the instruments of the heart and hand of God the Father. And tell him that no prize, however noble, is worth...
John hesitated and drew his trembling fingers to his eyes.
No, pay that no mind. Speak only what I told you about the sword. Tell him that.
I shall, my king,
said Towser. He frowned, although he had solved the knot.
I will gladly do your wish.
Good.
Prester John leaned back once more in his dragonbone chair and closed his grey eyes.
Sing for me again, Taos.
Towser did. Above, the dusty banners seemed to sway slightly, as if a whisper passed among the crowd of watchers, among the ancient herons and dull-eyed bears, and others stranger still. Chapter 2. A Two-Frog Story.
An idle mind is the devil's seedbed.
Simon reflected ruefully on this, one of Rachel's favorite expressions, as he stared down at the display of horse armor which now lay scattered the length of the chaplain's walking hall. A moment before, he had been leaping happily down the long, tiled hallway, which ran along the outer length of the chapel, on his way to sweep Dr. Morgani's chambers. He had been waving the broom about a little, of course, pretending it was the tree and drake flag of Prester John's Erkengard, and that he was leading them into battle. Perhaps he should have been paying better heed to where he was waggling it, but what sort of idiot would hang a suit of horse armor in the chaplain's hallway anyway? Needless to say, the clatter had been ferocious, and Simon expected skinny, vengeful Father Dreyosan to descend at any minute. Hurrying to gather up the dingy armor plates, some of which had torn loose from the leather straps that bound the suit together, Simon considered another of Rachel's maxims: the devil finds chores for empty hands. That was silly, of course, and made him angry. It was not the emptiness of his hands or the idleness of his thoughts that got him into trouble. No, it was the doing and the thinking that tripped him up time and time again. If only they would leave him alone. Father Dreyosan had still not made an entrance by the time he at last worried the armor into a precarious stack, then hastily pushed it beneath the skirt of a table rug. In doing so, he nearly upset the golden reliquary seated on the tabletop. But at last, and with no further mishaps, the sundered armor was gone from view, with nothing but a slightly cleaner-looking patch on the wall to proclaim that the suit had ever existed at all. Simon picked up his broom and scuffed away at the sooty stone, trying to even up the edges so that the bright spot was not so noticeable, then hurried on down the hall and out past the winding choir loft stairs. Emerging once more into the hedge garden from which he had been so brutally abducted by the dragon, Simon halted for a moment to inhale the pungent smell of greenery, to drive the last of the tallow soap stench from his nostrils. His eye was caught by an unusual shape in the upper branches of the festival oak, an ancient tree at the far end of the garden, so gnarled and convoluted of branch that it looked as though it had grown for centuries beneath a giant bushel basket. He squinted, hand raised to block the slanting sunlight. A bird's nest, and so late in the year. It was a very near thing. He had dropped the broom and taken several steps into the garden before he remembered his mission to Morgane's. If it had been any other errand, he would have been up the tree in an instant. But getting to see the doctor was a treat, even when it entailed work. He promised himself that the nest would not remain long unexamined, and passed on through the hedges and into the courtyard before the inner bailey gate. Two figures had just entered the gate and were coming toward him, one slow and stumpy, the other stumpier and slower still. It was Jacob the Chandler and his assistant Jeremias. The latter was carrying a large, heavy-looking bag over his shoulder, and walking, if such was possible, more sluggishly than usual. Simon called a greeting as they passed. Jacob smiled and waved.
"Rachel wants new candles for the dining room," the chandler shouted. "So candles she gets."
Jeremias made a sour face. A short trot down the sloping greensward brought Simon to the massive gatehouse. A sliver of afternoon sun still smoldered above the battlements behind him, and the shadows of the pennants of the western wall flopped like dark fish on the grass. The red and white liveried guard, scarcely older than Simon, smiled and nodded as the master spy pounded past, deadly broom in hand, head held low in case the tyrant Rachel should happen to peep from one of the keep's high windows. Once through the barbican and hidden in the lee of the high gate wall, he slowed to a walk. Green Angel Tower's attenuated shadow bridged the moat, the distorted silhouette of the angel triumphant on her spire, lay in a pool of fire at the water's farthest edge. As long as he was here, Simon decided, he might as well catch some frogs. It shouldn't take too long, and the doctor frequently had use for such things. It wouldn't really be putting off the errand, so much as expanding the nature of the service. He would have to hurry, though. Evening was coming on swiftly. Already he could hear the crickets laboriously tuning up for what would be one of the waning year's last performances, and the bullfrogs beginning their muffled, clunking counterpoint. Wading out into the lily-crusted water, Simon paused for a moment to listen, and to watch the eastern sky darkening to a dull violet. Next to Dr. Morgani's chambers, the moat was his favorite spot in all creation. All of it that he had seen so far, anyway. With an unconscious sigh, he pulled off his shapeless cloth hat and sloshed along toward where the pond grass and hyacinths were thickest. The sun had completely vanished, and the wind was hissing through the cattails ringing the moat, by the time Simon had reached the middle bailey, to stand, clothes adrip and a frog in each pocket, before the door of Morgani's chambers. He knocked on the stout panelling, careful not to touch the unfamiliar symbol chalked on the wood. He had learned by hard experience not to carelessly lay hands on something of the doctor's without asking. Several moments passed before Morgani's voice was heard.
"Go away," it said in a tone of annoyance.
"It's me, Simon," called Simon, and knocked again. There was a longer pause this time, then the sound of rapid footfalls. The door swung open. Morgani's, whose head barely reached Simon's chin, stood framed in bright blue light, the expression on his face obscured. For a moment, he seemed to stare.
"What?"
he said finally.
"Who?"
Simon laughed.
"Me, of course. Do you want some frogs?"
He pulled one of the captives from its prison and held it up by a slippery leg.
"Oh, oh."
The doctor seemed to be coming awake as from a deep sleep. He shook his head.
"Simon, but naturally. Come in, boy. My apologies. I am a little distracted."
He opened the door wide enough for Simon to slip past him into the narrow inner hallway, then pulled it closed again.
"Frogs, is it? Mmm, frogs."
The doctor angled past and led him along the corridor. In the glow of the blue lamps that lined the hall, the doctor's spindly form, monkey-like, seemed to bound instead of walk. Simon followed, his shoulders nearly touching the cold stone walls on either side. He could never understand how rooms that seemed as small as the doctor's did from outside, he could look down on them from the bailey walls and paced the distance in the courtyard, how they could have such long corridors. Simon's musings were interrupted by a hideous eruption of noise echoing down the passageway. Whistles, bangs, and something that sounded like the hungry baying of 100 hounds. Morgani's jumped in surprise and said,
"Oh, name of a name, I forgot to snuff the candles. Wait here."
The small man hurried down the hallway, wispy white hair fluttering, pulled the door at the end open just a crack. The howling and whistling doubled its intensity and slipped quickly inside. Simon heard a muffled shout. The horrendous noise abruptly ceased, as quickly and completely as
the snuffing of a candle, he thought.
The doctor poked his head out, smiled, and beckoned him in. Simon, who had witnessed scenes of this type before, followed Morgani's cautiously into his workshop. A hasty entrance could at the very least cause one to step on something strange and unpleasant to contemplate. There was now not a trace of whatever had set up that fearful yammering. Simon again marveled at the discrepancy between what Morgani's room seemed to be, a converted guard barracks, perhaps 20 paces in length, nestled against the ivy-tangled wall of the middle bailey's northeastern corner, and the view inside, which was of a low-ceilinged but spacious chamber, almost as long as a tournament field, although not nearly so wide. In the orange light that filtered down from the long row of small windows overlooking the courtyard, Simon peered at the farthest end of the room and decided he would be hard-pressed to hit it with a stone from the doorway in which he stood. This curious stretching effect, however, was quite familiar. In fact, Despite the terrifying noises, the whole chamber seemed much as it usually did, as though a horde of crack-brained peddlers had set up shop and then made a hasty retreat during a wild windstorm. The long refractory table that spanned the length of the near wall was littered with fluted glass tubes, boxes, and cloth sacks of powders and pungent salts, as well as intricate structures of wood and metal from which depended retorts and files and other unrecognizable containers. The centerpiece of the table was a great brazen ball with tiny angled spouts protruding from its shiny skin. It seemed to float in a dish of silvery liquid, the both of them balanced at the apex of a carved ivory tripod. The spouts chuffed steam, and the brass globe slowly revolved. The floor and shelves were littered with even stranger articles. Polished stone blocks and brooms and leather wings were strewn across the flagstones, vying for space with animal cages, some empty, some not. Metal armatures of unknown creatures covered with ragged pelts or mismatched feathers. Sheets of seemingly clear crystal stacked haphazardly against the tapestried walls. And everywhere, books, 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 dropped halfway open or propped upright here and there about the chamber like huge clumsy butterflies. There were also glass balls of colored liquids that bubbled without heat, and a flat box of glittering black sand that rearranged itself endlessly, as if swept by unfelt desert breezes. Wooden cabinets on the wall from time to time disgorged painted wooden birds, who cheeped impertinently and disappeared. Beside these hung maps of countries with totally unfamiliar geography, although geography admittedly was not something Simon felt too confident about. Taken altogether, the doctor's lair was a paradise for a curious young man, without doubt the most wonderful place in Austin-Ard. Morganis had been pacing about in the far corner of the room, beneath a drooping star chart that linked the bright celestial points together by painted line to make the shape of an odd, four-winged bird. With a little whistle of triumph, the doctor suddenly leaned down and began to dig like a squirrel in spring. A flurry of scrolls, brightly painted flannels, and miniature flatware and goblets from some homunculate supper table rose in the air behind him. At last, he straightened up, hefting a large glass-sided box. He waded to the table, set the glass cube down, and picked a pair of flasks out of a rack, apparently at random. The liquid in one of them was the color of the sunset skies outside. It smoked like a censer. The other was full of something blue and viscous, which flowed ever so slowly down into the box as Morganis upended the two flasks. Mixing, the fluids turned as clear as mountain air. The doctor threw his hand out like a traveling performer, and there was a moment's pause. "Frogs?" Morganis asked, waggling his fingers. Simon rushed forward, pulling the two he had caught out of his coat pockets. The doctor took them and dropped them into the tank with a flourish. The pair of surprised amphibians plunked into the transparent liquid, sank slowly to the bottom, then began to swim vigorously about in their new home. Simon laughed, with as much surprise as amusement.
"Is it water?"
The old man turned to look at him with bright eyes.
"More or less, more or less. So."
Now Morganis dragged long, bent fingers through his sparse fringe of beard.
"So, thank you for the frogs. I think I know what to do with them already. Quite painless. They may even enjoy it, although I doubt they'll like wearing the boots."
"Boots?" wondered Simon. But the doctor was off and bustling again, this time pushing a stack of maps from a low stool. He beckoned Simon to sit.
"Well then, young man, what will you take as due coin for your day's work? A fithing piece? Or perhaps you would like coxindrillis here for a pet?"
Chuckling, the doctor brandished a mummified lizard. Simon hesitated for a moment over the lizard. It would be a lovely thing to slip into the linen basket for the new girl Hepzibah to discover. But no. The thought of the chambermaids and cleaning stuck in his mind, irritating him. Something wanted to be remembered, but Simon pushed it back.
"No,
he said at last. I'd like to hear some stories.
Stories?
Morgainis bent forward quizzically.
Stories? You would be much better off going to old Shem Horsegroom in the stables, if you want to hear such things.
Not that kind, Simon said hastily. He hoped he hadn't offended the little man. Old people were so sensitive. Stories about real things, how things used to be, battles, dragons, things that happened.
Ah!
Morgaini sat up, and the smile returned to his pink face.
I see. You mean history.
The doctor rubbed his hands.
That's better. Much better.
He sprang to his feet and began pacing, stepping nimbly over the oddments scattered about the floor.
Well, what do you want to hear about, lad? The fall of Narved? The battle of Ach Samrath?
Tell me about the castle, Simon said. The Hayholt. Did the king build it? How old is it?
The castle.
The doctor stopped pacing, plucked up a corner of his worn, shiny grey robe, and began to rub absently at one of Simon's favourite curiosities, a suit of armour, exotically designed and coloured in wildflower bright blues and yellows, made entirely from polished wood.
The castle, Morgainis repeated. Well, that's certainly a two-frog story, at the very least. Actually, if I were to tell you the whole story, you would have to drain the moat and bring your warty prisoners in by the cartload to pay for it. But it is the bare bones of the tale that I think you want today, and I can certainly give you that. Hold yourself still for a moment while I find something to wet my throat.
As Simon tried to sit quietly, Morgainis went to his long table and picked up a beaker of brown, frothy liquid. He sniffed it suspiciously, brought it to his lips, and downed a small gulp. After a moment of consideration, he licked his bare upper lip and pulled his beard happily.
Ah, the stench it dark. No doubt on the subject. Ale is the stuff. What were we talking about then? Oh, yes, the castle.
Morgainis cleared a place on the table and then, holding his flask carefully, vaulted up with surprising ease to sit, slippered feet dangling half a cubit above the floor. He sipped again.
I'm afraid this story starts long before our King John. We shall begin with the first men and women to come to Austin Ard. Simple folk, living on the banks of the Gleniwent. They were mostly herdsmen and fisherfolk, perhaps driven out from the lost west over some land bridge that no longer exists. They caused little trouble for the masters of Austin Ard.
But I thought you said they were the first to come here, Simon interrupted, secretly pleased he had caught Morgainis in a contradiction.
No, I said they were the first men. The Scythi held this land long before any man walked on it.
You mean there really were little folk? Simon grinned. Just like Shem Horsegroom tells of. Pukas and Niskis and all. This was exciting. Morgaini shook his head vigorously and took another swallow.
Not only were, although that jumps ahead of my narrative, and they are by no means little folk. Wait, lad. Let me go on.
Simon hunched forward and tried to look patient.
Yes? Well, as I mentioned, the men and Scythi were peaceful neighbours. True, there was an occasional dispute over grazing land or some such. But since mankind seemed no real threat, the fair folk were generous. As time went on, men began to build cities. Sometimes only a half a day's walk from Scythi lands. Later still a great kingdom arose on the rocky peninsula of Naban, and the mortal men of Austin Ard began to look there for guidance. Are you still following my trail, boy?
Simon nodded.
Good.
A long draught.
Well, the land seemed quite big enough for all to share, until Black Iron came over the water.
What? Black iron? Simon was immediately stilled by the doctor's sharp look.
The shipmen out of the near-forgotten west. The Rimmer's men,
Morganis continued.
They landed in the north, armed men fierce as bears, riding in their long serpent boats.
The Rimmer's men? Simon wondered. Like Duke Iskrimnor at the court? On boats?
They were great seafarers before they settled here, the Duke's ancestors,
Morganis affirmed.
But when they first came, they were not searching for grazing or farming land, but for plunder. Most importantly, though, they brought iron, or at least the secret of shaping it. They made iron swords and spears, weapons that would not break like the bronze of Austin Ard, weapons that could beat down even the witchwood of the city.
Morganis rose and refilled his beaker from a covered bucket standing on a cathedral of books beside the wall. Instead of returning to the table, he stopped to finger the shiny epaulettes of the armor suit.
None stood against them for long. The cold, hard spirit of the iron seemed in the shipmen themselves as much as in their blades. Many folk fled south, moving closer to the protection of Naban's frontier outposts. The Nabane legions, well-organized garrison forces, resisted for a while. Finally, they too were forced to abandon the Frost March to the Rimmer's men. There was much slaughter.
Simon squirmed happily.
What about the Scythi? You said they had no iron?
It was deadly to them.
The doctor licked his finger and rubbed away a spot on the polished wood of the breastplate.
Even they could not defeat the Rimmer's men in open battle. But,
he pointed the dusty finger at Simon,